But right now, the Observation Deck with Gordo, brought to us by A Number One Air.
Thank you so much, Miller Man. There was an article that went around, virally passed around last week about big data's role in Trump's victory. Do you know what big data is?
No.
Okay, so our lives now have such a digital tail that we drag around behind us, right? All the likes we've put out there, all the tweets we've made and written, all the retweets that we've done, all paint a picture of ourselves, and all this stuff is collected and captured. And these data farms, they have this. And, you know, that's why, you know, the old saying, if you're not paying for a service, then you're the product. Mm-hmm. You ever heard that saying? Mm-hmm. What that means is these, you know, Google's offering you something for free and Facebook's offering you something for free. There is a reason it's free, is because the information they get from you is worth more than your dollars would be to pay for that service. And the information that these companies get for you is your life. They know everything about you. And that is very valuable in a consumer-based culture because they can micro-target you with advertisements. And it makes advertising that much more effective. Well, this article goes around about how Trump hired this company based in London called Cambridge Analytica. And that company...
Hello.
And the way the article unfolds is it's like almost dark sorcery. And they use psychometry, which is this approach that they basically map people's personality on the OCEAN criteria. And that's O-C-E-A-N, which stand for openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism. We can all be put, you know, we all have like an OCEAN score, mm-hmm. right, that describes our personality. And what this company does, and there's many companies that do this, is they learn how to micro-target you because they know exactly what you will respond to because they've seen what you've responded to for the past 15 years. Hmm. And so they know you in, and there's an interesting part in this article where it talks about, you know, give me 10 likes and I know you better than your acquaintances. Mm-hmm. Give me 20 likes, I know you better than your friends. Give me 80 likes, I know you better than your parents. 100, I know you better than your partner. 300, I know you better than yourself. Something like that is in the article. And which is a fascinating idea because most of us don't know ourselves that well. We have a story we tell ourselves about ourselves. I'm a guy who believes this and, you know, this is what means most to me. But when you look at that person's life, you see that his behavior does not indicate that that's the thing that's most important to him. And this is his deep abiding core principle.
Right. We don't know our own patterns.
We don't know our own patterns. Yeah. We don't know ourselves. But these companies, who advertisers and people who use big data, they do know us. And they do know what we respond to. So the article unfolds how Trump hires this company and he starts micro-targeting people on Facebook with what are called dark posts. And I'm not exactly sure what that means, but it means it's not visible to a lot of people. It's kind of going to you, but it has the appearance of being maybe more broadcasted than micro-targeted, mm-hmm. right? And what it does is it knows your personality. And it knows things that, you know, formerly advertisers used to know, like, you know, you're a Second Amendment supporter, for example. You like the right to own guns. But not all Second Amendment supporters are the same. So, George, I may serve you an ad, a Second Amendment ad that's pro-Trump, that it has on it a burglar breaking into a home and someone reaching for a pistol in their nightstand. Mm-hmm. Because I know that you're more of a fear-based guy. Mm-hmm. And, Craig, I may target you with a grandfather and father and son out in a field with a shotgun with the birds circling overhead because you, on your OCEAN score, favor traditionalism and you have nostalgia. You're a very nostalgic person. Mm-hmm. So I know exactly how to play both of you, and I don't play you the same way to get you to do what I want you to do, which is vote for this candidate. So what it does is it gets to the point where we are leaving such our trail behind us to where we can be controlled. And we don't know we're being controlled and manipulated. Trump does this on Facebook, hires his company, and lo and behold, he ends up winning the election.
Interesting.
This is the, yeah, that's the idea of the piece. And that, you know, and it wasn't just to promote people to vote for him. Sometimes it was to suppress votes in, like, for Hillary Clinton, they would target African-Americans with ads against Hillary that show Hillary saying super predator, you know, the famous super predator thing about young African-American males being super predators. We need to get these guys off the streets. That whole soundbite. So it may not make them vote for Trump, obviously, but it makes them lose enthusiasm for Hillary Clinton.
Right.
And then, lo and behold, Trump wins the election. And the article unfolds and is very ominous. And it is very ominous, but this is going on at all levels. Trump wasn't the first to do it. As a matter of fact, Hillary's campaign was doing it just as much. Obama's campaign was the first one to really use all this big data to win. And Hillary had all of Obama's information and then whatever more her team had gleaned. So it wasn't just this that made Trump win. But it does open up the, pull back the curtain of a kind of an unsettling world, particularly when we've now started facing things like, you know, we're not seeing the same world anymore because we have our different news channels and we have our Facebook feed that curates things for us.
Yep.
And there's such a danger to the recommended for you culture because now we're always micro-targeted. Our ads can be micro-targeted. Our news is micro-targeted. It's not a central source for news. We all disagree on what even the facts are because we just have, I want to go to the place that tells me the facts that I already like. So as this moves on and this progresses, I think we're going to have not only advertisements that target us perfectly, we're going to have news that already targets us perfectly, but then it'll just shut out the rest of the news so you don't even have to hear the alternate narrative. And imagine a world in which nobody has to hate the press because the press, the reason we hate them now is because they tell us things are true that we either one, don't think are true, or two, don't want to be true, so we hate the messenger. But now we can have a world in which we don't even have to hate the messenger because the messenger is telling us the exact thing we want to hear, and it feels good, and the world is exactly the way I feel it is.
That's wild. Have you guys experienced the, if you've searched something online like a product?
I hate it.
And all of a sudden that product will start showing up.
Yeah. I hate it. And all this is billed as convenience for us. But it's convenient for them because it means they can sell you stuff better.
Yeah.
And you'll click on it more. And I think this is eventually going to get to our own entertainment. Imagine a TV show to where you're watching it and they know the exact, they film different versions of it, right? They know which are your most taut emotional cords that when plucked, you always love this particular kind of ending. You always love when someone sacrifices to do this. Or you always love when someone uses force to gain the objective. So now we can actually make, hey, did you watch The Wire? Yeah, I watched The Wire. We watched slightly different versions of it, let's say. One played your emotional cords, one played mine, but we all agree this was the greatest program we ever saw. It was so
tailored
perfect.
To us. Yeah.
It was tailored perfectly to us. So once we get entertainment in that, it is bespoke, and we all live in these bespoke worlds that are perfect for us, then what is reality anymore? You know, then what is
We've
the common
it.
Experience that we're all debating and talking about?
Well, that whole Big Brother thing, nothing creeps me out more than not just going to, let's say, my MSN.com homepage and seeing an ad for something that I've been searching for, a pair of shoes in the last couple of days. That creeps me out. But even more, I'll pull out my phone and let's say I click on where I am and the map pops up. And it'll show on the map, let's say I'm in Austin, and it'll show reservation at this hotel February 12th, check in at 3 p.m. And I'm thinking, how does the map know that I have this hotel reservation, but there's this giant Big Brother Google system, whatever they've got in place, that takes things from your email, from your text messages.
It's all integrated.
Everything is one.
And it conveniences you into basically some sort of servitude. You're at the if they know everything about your life, but it's convenient for you. We trade convenience for lack of privacy all the time, and we just count on the people who are doing it to just always do the right thing. I mean, they wouldn't try to game me to get more money out of me. You would never have, nobody's going to get elected president that would be totalitarian, that would actually use any of these tools against anyone. Oh, wait. Wait, some people are saying that Trump may be that guy, you know, or a lot of people thought Obama was that guy. It's just, do you trust the government? We all talk about not trusting politicians, except when it comes to them being in bed with the big companies that have all our information.
Once again, my theory that we are living in the sweet spot is going to be proven true 100 years, 1,000 years down the road. We got the old school, kids going out and playing with sticks, and now we're experiencing the new school, the Big Brother and the internet and all of that. We lived in the sweet spot. I don't think I would have want to live 100 years from now or 200 years from now.
One of the great ways that big data would get information about your personality, hey, here's a free personality test. See how well you score.
Right.
And people would fill it out and everything.
That is fascinating.
Yeah.
All right, Gordo, thanks. That's the OJ.
Watch Black Mirror also, by the way, on Netflix. Great series about the corrosion that this technological age is going to could possibly bring about.
On Netflix.
Really good on Netflix, yeah.
Okay.
I'm nobody.
That's the ODEX 642 here on the ticket. But first, it's 7:15 and time to muse in the news with the great Gordo, brought to us by D&M Leasing and All Pro Foundation Repair.
Thank you so much, Craig Miller. Well, it was a plan that didn't quite work out. An Arlington guy is accused of kidnapping his ex-girlfriend from her Las Vegas home and was trying to bring her to a cave to brainwash her into being his wife.
Wow. Jeez. There's a lot going on there.
Yeah, there is. It's cave is a very low-tech environment.
Yeah. Who uses a cave these days for anything?
Batman.
No, people. Batman and someone like Ted Kaczynski, maybe.
I thought he's
not using them anymore.
Didn't he have
a
little hut? Yeah.
And I think that cabin went up for auction at one point.
I'm surprised you weren't in on the bidding.
Tom Hanks, Castaway, he had a cave.
That's
a movie. That's fictitious, not like Batman.
Yeah.
Well, that was not
Batman's real.
Okay, I thought it was a documentary. Sorry.
A witness called Vegas police on January 30th and reported that a woman was being dragged from an apartment wearing only undergarments, and she was put into a van with Texas plates. So cops go into her apartment. They find a stun gun and a knife near the front door, and another witness tells police that the man that they saw take her matched the description of her ex-boyfriend, a 35-year-old guy named Jack Morgan. And this woman and Morgan had dated in college, but the relationship had been violent, according to the woman's father. And so they break up, and then, lo and behold, I think it was a matter of over a year later, they get back in contact, and she says that she'll, I guess, meet with him a week before the abduction. They met for coffee. And so he tries to follow her, I think, home, and then that didn't work. And he had some friend of his pretend to be soliciting for religious donations to find out which was her apartment. Wow. They find out which one. He and a buddy had been planning it for a year.
Gosh.
To do this. But anyway, he was stopped by officers in a van while he was driving the van with her in it, and they hear someone screaming in the back.
Why did they pull him over?
I'm not sure whether it was a traffic violation or something like that, or whether it was I think it may have been because they were looking for a van of that description. So they pull it over, they hear her screaming in the back, they open it up, and there she is back there padlocked and chained into the back of the van. So she was hospitalized with cuts and scrapes to her arms and legs. The FBI is taking over the investigation, and the guy is in jail along with his accomplice friend.
They should get life.
Brainwash cave thing didn't work so well. In other news, Trump's has offered to destroy a Texas senator to help out the Rockwall sheriff, Rockwall County here. There were a group of sheriffs that were meeting with the president yesterday, and the sheriff complained about a state senator who wanted to make it harder for law enforcement to get control of assets forfeited by drug traffickers. And Trump said to him, "Do you want to give me his name? We'll destroy his career."
God. Think he's drunk with power?
Oh, my gosh.
We'll destroy
the president saying we'll destroy his career. the sheriff declined to give the name to Trump, but said that he didn't take the president's offer to destroy the senator literally. He thinks he was just being emphatic. And okay. I can see that. I can see that. Yeah, I think Trump was being emphatic, but it is telling to me that the sheriff didn't quite hand over the name. I don't think he's serious, right. But just in case, which isn't that kind of the way I think all of America, including Trump supporters, even think of him. You know, he's not okay. He's not serious, but let's just keep an eye on it. Let's just see what's up. Anyway, Trump has beat Obama and Bush in one particular stat. You know what it is?
Worst approval rating ever in the first couple of weeks.
That's probably correct, but I'm talking about a different
one. Oh.
I bet it's number of actions signed or number of things.
Your explanation takes too long.
Started in the first 2 weeks of their presidency.
I got tired.
Executive orders?
No. First round of golf.
Already?
Barack Hussein Obama! Played golf 4 months into his presidency. That's when he first played golf.
Okay.
Took him 4 months. George W. Bush went even longer. Took him 5.5 months into his first term before he played golf. Trump made it 2 weeks. Now, it's kind of misleading because he basically White Houses half the time from Mar-a-Lago, which is his own resort down there, and there's a golf course right there. And so he spent about 8 hours on last Saturday and Sunday playing golf, and he'll be taking his clubs out again this weekend as he's scheduled to play with the Japanese prime minister.
Oh, no.
That's where World War III is going to start.
On the course?
Yeah. On the course with Trump.
He's going to cheat. He's going to offend.
Yeah,
and
then the Japanese prime minister gets upset by the cheating, and it starts off with, you know, come on, Donald, you don't have to do that.
What, I didn't do anything?
I had a five.
No, you did. I saw you.
No,
you know,
I had a five.
I mean, it's no big deal, but I mean, just admit that you did it. I mean, you know, you kicked it back.
Put me down for a five.
But I just don't think you should put down a five. You didn't get it.
Look, put down a five. Do you want me to nuke you?
Now, I don't think you have to go that far. If you nuke us, we'll nuke you.
All right, let's see.
Let's go.
You're and fired. Then boom, we're all dead. Speaking of Barack Hussein Obama, have you seen the pictures of him?
He's having a good time.
It's so decadent looking, though. All these pictures are coming out about him kite surfing and high-fiving Richard Branson, who's the most ridiculously rich man in the world with the long, flowing hair and building his own spaceships and whatever else Richard Branson does. But Obama and his family goes out and they spend time on this, is it a private island? I don't know, with Richard Branson. And the photos that come out about it just seem so one-percenter. So one-percenter. Yeah, they're high-fiving and kite surfing.
Well, that is an interesting line that I think in particular popular Democrats or Democratic candidates or office holders have to walk, because they're supposed to be
the
party of the common man. But then you see Hillary 2 days before the election hamming it up with Bruce Springsteen and Bon Jovi. And,
right.
And, you know, the news gets out about Chelsea's $10 million wedding or whatever crazy number it was. And then you see Obama kite surfing with Richard Branson.
That's where conservatives have it right. You know, you can be rich and you just say, look, this is an example of American success, you know? Mm-hmm. So there's no, you're right. There's no moral, what is it, dissonance there? There's no conflict there. But when you're the champion of the common people and you live like John Edwards did,
right?
It just kind of leaves a bad taste in your mouth.
What's the message here? I
don't know.
Confused.
I don't know. And so, yeah, that's what Barack Hussein Obama is doing. You notice the one thing he wasn't doing in those pictures?
Reading the Constitution.
Reading the Constitution!
Music.
Why does that crack me up so much?
I don't know.
He's obsessed with Barack Obama reading the Constitution. We're, of course, talking about the great one, Mark Levin. See, Mr. Producer, don't line up these calls. Don't even talk to him, Mr. Producer.
Nobody.
Mr. Producer. So, Stevie Wonder, is he blind?
Yes. Donovan says no.
Donovan is a Stevie Wonder truther. He says that Stevie is not blind. And there's been several things. What's that?
I'm just keeping an eye on Jared.
What do you do?
Like the brrr.
I do have to say, that one video of Stevie Wonder in the press conference with Paul McCartney and the mic stand gets knocked over and Stevie reaches out and grabs it. That is the one thing.
It wasn't a press conference. That was a... I thought that was a performance. Yes, that was weird.
That made me wonder.
But I think
Donovan's
Stevie was just
right.
Putting his arms out, you know, while he was singing. He wasn't grabbing the falling
mic stand.
Lucky grab. Uh-huh. But other evidence that Stevie may not be blind is his penchant for attending basketball games. Like, why is he always at the basketball game?
He likes to hear the crowd.
Okay, we'll get some recordings. Yes, the falling mic stand.
Are you
There's
excited?
Also a picture of him taking a picture that has made the rounds. Shows him with a camera taking a picture. Why would he be doing that? And apparently he was speaking to a paparazzi dude at who worked for TMZ at the LAX airport, right? And the paparazzi guy asked him, Stevie says, I flew a plane once, well, actually twice. Hmm. So Stevie makes that claim. He flew a plane. And so the photographer asked him if he would ever come out that he actually is sighted. And Stevie responded, in this year, I will reveal the truth.
Are you sighted?
So is he playing with us, or is he going to come out and say,
man,
Donovan was right?
See?
How great would it be if he granted Norm the exclusive interview to announce whether he could see or not, and it sounded something like this.
Are you sighted? Can you see?
Are you gay?
Okay, Norm, you're going too far. That's beyond the scope of that particular interview.
We're all black friends.
Oh, God.
See, I think it would be great if Stevie keeps doing trolling acts and keeps trolling us with, you know, evidence that he may be sighted. And one of the gags that I think would be good, I think he actually did a James Corden carpool karaoke. Mm-hmm. But how funny would it have been if Stevie said, whoa, whoa, watch out, watch out. And James Corden had to break, you know, for at an intersection.
Right,
Stevie, Stevie, yeah. Not this light, but the next one. That'd be awesome. All right.
Are you sighted?
Have you...
No.
That's not Stevie. You've been following the David Beckham email scandal.
No.
So over the weekend, there was a bunch of emails between David Beckham and his innermost circle that were leaked to a website called Football Leaks. And also to several media outlets. And they were reportedly stolen by hackers who worked for a sports management firm run by this PR guru guy. I don't know. I don't understand it all. But
generic.
They didn't have, they didn't release any like nudes of him or, you know, him cheating on Victoria Beckham or anything like that. But they showed him to be this insecure kind of whiny guy who was obsessed with becoming knighted.
Are you knighted? Are you knighted?
He insulted the committee responsible for selecting future knights. He called them unappreciative. And then you know what you do on fourth down a lot?
Yeah.
But this one had a different first letter than...
Cunning stunt.
And someone offering him some particular honor in this email, and he wrote, unless it's a knighthood, blank off. He really wants to be a knight.
Wow,
he wants to get
so.
Knighted.
Man.
But they say that they have millions of his emails, over a million of his emails, and that they will release more. So he's very nervous, they say, because there's more stuff that they have. They have access to all his email.
Have you sent 1 million emails? They have millions of his emails?
Well, I'm assuming a lot of this is to him as well.
Okay.
So Yeah. So Becky leaks. We're following. And they tried to apparently blackmail him, tried to get €1 million out of him in exchange for not releasing the emails. Do you do that if you're David Beckham? Say, no. Pay $1 million to not take any sort of PR hit?
No, because the PR hit probably lasts 3 days.
I think that the you pay them the million. They didn't copy them. They're not going to keep any of them.
You're going to have
pranksters.
To pay them.
They're going
to
keep going.
Yeah, you'll have to pay them another million in a year.
Right.
Or in 2 years.
Or whenever they want them, the next million.
Yeah.
All right, let's do birthdays. Composer, conductor John Williams is 85. Goodness. True greatness.
Well, yes. I guess.
We ought to someday review all the great themes that he wrote. The theme to Jaws.
How do you write and arrange all those parts?
Star Wars. What else to do? Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
Superman.
Dancing with Superman the Stars. Too?
Dancing with the Stars.
F-Troop.
F-Troop.
Gilligan's Island.
Gilligan's Island.
Ticket stock theme.
Mm-hmm.
That's enough.
Okay. Ted Koppel is 77.
Greatness.
Nightline.
Nick Nolte is 76. Gave us one of the greatest mug shots of all time.
Mm-hmm.
When he got busted in a Hawaiian shirt after giving himself the date rape drug. Robert Klein, the comedian, is 75. I believe we've had him in studio.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Creed Batten from The Office is 74. He's a guitarist, actor. Mary Steenburgen is 64, and I'm with Craig. She needs to change her last name.
It should be Steam Virgin.
Right. Even though that doesn't make any sense either, it makes more sense than how nonsense this
Steam Virgin.
Yeah.
It should be Steam Virgin.
John Grisham is 62. Nobody has any opinion on that?
I've never read any of his work.
Huh. Vince Neil of Motley Crue, 56. Mary McCormick is 48.
Mary or Maureen?
This says Mary McCormick.
Oh.
Seth Green from Austin Powers is 43.
Green?
Okay.
Cecily Strong from Saturday Night Live is 33. Musician Joey Ryan of Milk Carton Kids is 35.
Oh, come on.
And Alonzo Mourning turns 47 today.
One of the worst guests. He's in the top three worst guests of all time, along with Adam Schefter and who else would be out there?
Well, I don't know. Those two are easy.
Those are the top two.
Cheech. Matthew Perry?
Yeah, maybe Matthew Perry rounds out the top three.
Remember how douchey he was when he was on?
So uninterested.
Boy, I wish we could find a copy of that Alonzo Mourning interview. When, what was the one that Rhines, they had some interview with somebody in Rhines?
Kenny Lofton.
Kenneth.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you're about as interested in this interview as we are, so we're going to let you go.
All right.
How old is Zoe?
Gosh. He is 47.
All right. Thanks, that's Muse, 7:33 on the ticket. Good time for Gordo's Corner, brought to us by Load Bearing Wall Pros and Baker Brothers Plumbing and Air.
Thank you so much, Craig. All right, before we get to our special in-studio guest, just a quick note here. We've had a notable Hollywood death.
Really?
Richard Hatch dying at the age of 71. Does that move your needle?
Sounds really familiar.
He played a hotshot pilot on Battlestar Galactica. Died at the age of 71 on Tuesday. That would have been, what, yesterday? Of pancreatic cancer in L.A.
The original series?
Yes. I think he returned later on as when they rebooted the Battlestar Galactica 2.
I remember Dirk Benedict and Lauren Green from the original TV series, but I don't remember Richard Hatch.
He's not the Richard Hatch who was on Survivor, the shirtless guy.
Oh, right.
Who was always getting busted for tax evasion. That may have not been on the show. I may get different time periods mixed up there. But anyway, Richard Hatch passed away at the age of 71. All right, let's talk to our special in-studio guest. Very excited to welcome Ewan Morton into the studio.
Yay.
Now, wow. Ewan, you're starring in, you're the title character of the production that's going on at the Windspear. Tell us about it.
Hedwig and the Angry Inch. It's a musical that appeared in New York in the late 90s. And it became kind of a cult hit. It's about a transgender woman who escaped from East Berlin by becoming a woman and ends up in Junction City, Kansas, alone, divorced, sort of dealing with her issues, and sort of finds her salvation in rock music with this band called The Angry Inch that she puts together. And they travel the U.S. singing insane songs and saying crazy but wonderful things about love. And it's really a story about love. Am I deserving of love? Are you deserving of love? What is love? And why do we bother? Kind of stuff.
And this was a big hit. Joseph Gordon-Levitt?
Neil Patrick Harris. One of those guys with three names. Neil Patrick won the Tony for it. So did Lena Hall. She won. There's another character in the piece called Yitzhak, who's Hedwig's husband, and that's actually played by a woman, although the character's not transgender, and it's just a, you know, like Peter Pan's played by a girl. They both won Tonys for it, I think, and the show won Tonys and all that good stuff. And the original actor John Cameron Mitchell also played on Broadway. It changes all the time. There's obviously, because it's a character and actors play characters, but what's nice about this is it's kind of all part of the journey. Like she's different with every actor that plays her. So some of them are more masculine, some of them are more aggressive, some of them are more beautiful, like me. I'm really lucky that I'm so gorgeous. You can't tell on the radio, but
you really are a very gorgeous man.
I was hoping you would say, "No, you're not. You really like. You can't tell."
And I don't know. I'm sure people listening on the radio can tell that you don't. You have an accent. You're
from
Scottish.
Scotland. Yay!
Falkirk. Falkirk Wheel.
You read it.
I've actually been on the Falkirk Wheel.
You have not.
I have.
It's a fascinating place, isn't it?
It is, man. I was fascinated by the engineering. To get between canals, you know, you have
it
to...
It lifts the boat up.
Lifts the boat up.
From
it's really cool.
To the other. Hmm.
Like towards Scotland, I did that.
I was going to guess you were from East Texas. I got
I had Oklahoma, so I was off too.
Yeah. I'm supposed to do a southern accent in this show, and it's been okay because we've been mostly in the East Coast.
Well, let's hear it.
No, I'm not doing it publicly.
Way to go, George. Putting him on the spot.
Yeah,
like
yeah, George.
We'll do our Scottish accent.
Okay, you go first.
Let's hear George's Scottish accent.
He's got to go first.
No. So it's kind of weird doing it in Dallas. And I think it's a bit sad. I told a JR joke yesterday, and then I felt really bad about it.
No one got it.
That's just easy stuff, and you shouldn't really go for the easy stuff. But
well, this is what's interesting about this this musical is that you get to improv a bit in this. There's some ad-libbing.
Yes, there is, and it's really good fun. I love it. I have my own band out there in the real world, and this is kind of what I do. I travel around and I talk nonsense and, you know, sing songs. And mine has less of a story than hers.
Is Craig Ferguson in your band? Just assume that all Scottish people.
All Scottish, but I do know Alan Cumming. Does that count?
Yeah.
No, he's not in the band, sadly. I haven't been in Scotland for a really long time. I lived in London for 9 years, and I've been in the U.S. for the last 14. In fact, I just became a U.S. citizen.
Congratulations.
Yes,
are you sure about that? You may want to check.
No. I mean, I know that things have changed in the U.S. recently. Yeah.
Did you become a U.S. citizen just to vote for Trump?
No, certainly not. I became a... It just happened. It took 2 years. The process took 2 years, and I finally did it in, I think, October or September, and I did. It was my first election I voted in. But even though things have changed politically in the U.S., quite drastically, I still have faith in Americans. I mean, I came here. I never wanted to come to America. It was not like, oh, God, I've got to get on Broadway. It just sort of happened. I always wanted to go to Australia because I just sort of fell in love with the beauty of Australia. But then I came here and I realized that on the whole, Americans are amazingly good people. I've traveled this whole country. I drive at least 25,000 miles a year to all these. I never take the highways. I go to all the little towns. Awesome. And actually, people in Texas, and I'm not just saying this because I dreaded Texas because it has such a terrible reputation when you live on the East Coast.
No, we're friendly down here.
Oh, my God, it's amazing. These people are fantastic. And it doesn't matter where you go, a tiny little town outside, or you go to Dallas or Amarillo, which I've been to a bunch of times, everyone's really lovely. And I thought, maybe it's me. Maybe I have a really limited version of Americans. And so I started traveling. And I have faith that when the worst times are here, that Americans of all colors and all creeds will actually work together. Like, Congress might not, but the people in America usually work together, even through our history, even the Civil War, even after the Civil War, there wasn't the acrimony that there is today, because people realized, we got to get on. The only way for America to work is for the East and the West and the Middle and the North and the South to get on by finding common ground, and I have absolute faith that we will.
I'm glad that you give people a chance and you're out there meeting face-to-face, because that's the thing. Once you meet someone face-to-face,
absolutely.
It turns out they're a lot nicer than you think.
I've met a bunch of white guys in West Virginia. I turn up, you know, walking down the street, looking and sounding the way that I do, to these really damaged towns like the City of War in West Virginia. There's nothing left. This high street is devastated. There's one restaurant, and the woman who owns it, her grandmother owned it. It's been in her family for 80 years. It's the last surviving thing in this coal town. I walked in, and, you know, the first thing she said was, what about that Obama? And she denigrated Obama. And she got right into her politics, as people kind of do in America now. But the longer we spoke, the more we realized that we had a lot in common. And we ended up, I met her mom, I met her daughter, she cooked me a free meal.
Wow.
Because people just want to get on. Once they actually meet and see who you are and realize that, oh, we're not that different. We are all poor. We are all struggling for healthcare. We are all funny. We are all unique. And we are all Americans, even me, and it's fantastic.
Now, in that city, were you performing this character, Hedvig?
No.
Okay. I would like to see how that would have gone on.
I'm not sure that would have gone quite so well. But, you know, Hedvig, although she is challenging and she does tell dirty jokes and say weird stuff, she also is really just saying, am I worthy of love? And at the end of the night, if the audience agrees that she is, then fundamentally speaking, you must be too. You as an audience member must be worthy of love if you can see it in others.
And that's what appeals to everyone watching this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
because we're all creatures who feel we deserve love, but... Actually, I would say we're all creatures who demand people love us, but inside we don't feel like we
deserve
love.
Mike, who loves you the least? Yourself, usually.
Yeah.
And this show is about finding a way to love yourself the most.
What's the name of your band?
My own band?
Yeah.
Grandpa Musselman and the Syncopators.
Wow. What a great name.
Wow. Yeah. That is awesome. Yeah.
And really, it's their band. I just come along in front of them. It's an amazing jazz brass band. It's all brass instruments. Yeah, it's really fantastic.
So you're just a singer. You don't play an instrument.
Well, I mean, I do play an instrument, but not publicly. I write with a guitar or a piano, but I mean, I play them so badly, I would never go out and play them publicly. They're just my sort of tool for chords and notes.
So you compose?
I like to say write.
Right, yeah. Compose a little too
high. Compose makes me sound like John Adams, or one of, not the president.
Yeah, well, John Adams, he's decomposing right now.
Yes, he is.
Doing the opposite. Thank
very
you,
Doreen. We're having fun now.
That's 23 years on the radio, man.
That's right. You get that kind of easy
by the way, I was just saying earlier, I'm on an award-winning show. This is very exciting.
Yes, we have won awards.
Yes, it's great. I'm really happy. I've never won anything in my life.
Oh,
never,
ever?
I bet you won
never.
Something.
What?
You won something for your stage work, haven't you? Nominated?
Oh, yeah, no, yeah, maybe I was nominated.
Yeah, there you go.
Always the bridesmaid.
Yeah. What about in a talent show, like in school? Did you?
I won a talent show once. So I won a hostess trolley. You ever heard of a hostess trolley? You know those things?
Oh, a little
cart. The 1970s, yeah. It's got a little cart, and you shove it with a meal on it, and you take it out to the table.
That was the prize?
Yeah.
That's just what they found.
Isn't that like, yeah, I was in this little town in Scotland, and the prize was a hostess trolley. You didn't even get the plates to go on it.
I think you found it in the closet and gave it to
How big a town is Falkirk?
Falkirk's like a town of maybe 30,000, 25,000,
30,000. That's
pretty
good size.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty good size. It has a main, it's a hub between Edinburgh and Glasgow. It's about 20 miles. West of Edinburgh and about 25 miles east of Glasgow. So it's a central train station. There's two train stations in the town.
So what are the Scottish people like? Are they self-hating people? Are they depressives? Are they happy? What
are they like, the characters in Braveheart?
Somewhat, yeah. There's a lot of ass showing. Can I say ass?
No. Yeah, sure.
Is it too early for ass?
No.
Never too early for ass.
They are a proud people. They are a well-traveled nation, even the ones that have never left, because they come from these families of travelers that went to farm in the U.S. I mean, many people who fought for the Union in the Civil War were Scottish people, some that fought for the South, too. So they're well-traveled, but they're also a little isolationist sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, they're a small country which has been invaded by England on three separate occasions. The last time was 400 years ago, and they never got free. They tried recently, and they still didn't do it. So there's sort of a sense of real pride. If you want to know who the Scots are, you should read the book How the Scots Invented the Modern World, which sounds, really self-aggrandizing. But once you've read this thing, I have no idea how amazing we are. Tarmac, the ATM, the pneumatic tire, chloroform, tape, tape?
Yeah, Scotch tape.
Yeah. Yeah. I was like, wait, tape?
waterproofing stuff?
Yeah.
Scotch guard.
Yeah, Scotch guard, exactly.
That's right.
You should read this thing. I mean, I've just named four, but there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them that came from this tiny little country of 5 million people.
Wow.
So they're innovators. The steam engine, James Harriet Watt, the television, the telephone, even though there's an American who will claim the television, they were done at the same time and Scotland did it first. There, I mean, it's a, I don't know why that's the case. I think maybe if you're lonely and live up a mountain with four sheep, you've got nothing else to do but invent. I got to invent something to make the sheep look like a human.
And everywhere I went over there, everything was a freaking battlefield. I mean, you talk about a warring people.
I mean, yeah, we were a warring. We warred with each other. Yeah. You know,
that's what the clans do.
Yeah.
They fight each other until until a common enemy comes in. Then we'll all fight the common enemy, and then when that enemy goes away, let's go back to fighting.
It's kind of like Mississippi.
Which is very different.
No, that is true, is that the Appalachian area was
The
was
accents
settled.
Are even still there.
Really?
It's actually very different from the clan in the U.S. who'll just fight everyone else.
Yeah, that's a different kind of clan.
That's a different clan.
But I'm of Scotch heritage myself.
You are?
Yeah.
Okay, let me tell you something. And I meet everyone I meet in America says I'm Scottish. That's my southern accent. There you are, because we did with the Irish and some of the Dutch really colonized this country. I mean, the Puritans, in large part, had Scottish and Irish influence. When the Highland Clearances came around in the early 18th century, the Scots were all escaped here, Nova Scotia, Massachusetts, and then spread out as farming. Grew and changed as tobacco farming grew. So I believe it. In fact, I'd be surprised if you didn't have Scottish influence.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, both of my names, Gordon and Keith, both Scottish clans.
Wow, and you have two first names as your name.
Two first names as my name, And I think the Keiths were involved in, is it Donater or Donater Castle?
How Donater. Do you pronounce
it? Donater. Yeah, I went up and visited that.
That was y'all's castle?
Keith's stronghold for a while, Robert Keith and all those guys.
You know, you can buy a piece of a castle. That's like a thing you can give a gift. Mm-hmm. And so I did it for a friend. And I was like, this is amazing. I wonder what piece you get. Do you get like, you know, a brick in the dining room?
Part of the latrine.
Part of a table. Part of a toilet.
Yeah. Mailbox. The actual drawbridge.
The actual drawbridge. What you actually get is a 1 foot square piece of scrubland, usually by the river, that you can't put anything on or do anything to. But it's yours, man.
All right, so this is running from, I guess it's tonight is the opening night?
No, last night actually was the opening.
Way to go, Gordon. How'd it go? Opening night.
Amazing. You guys are great. We've just come from another city I shall not name, and it wasn't quite as lively and as connected as last night. I was really surprised. I was really happy.
You can say Fort Worth.
Actually, no, Durham.
Durham, North Carolina. But didn't you make a joke about
The bathroom?
Yeah.
Yeah, of course I did. I mean, yes.
The bathroom bill.
Well, two of them. The first one, I would start the evening by saying we have to make the show very quickly, ladies and gentlemen, because I haven't been to the bathroom for 4 days.
Yeah.
And the other one was that there's a line in the show where I can, you know, make a sort of any kind of joke, and I said I'd just been barred, because that's usually what it is, I'd just been barred from the gender neutral bathroom at Pat McCrory's house. Because if you think about it, right, when you go home your bathroom is gender neutral.
Mm-hmm. Right.
If you go home and your wife or your partner has said to you, oh, by the way, honey, I've organized a dinner party for tonight, and you're like, who the hell have you invited? Oh, the PTA. And you don't know any of these people in the PTA, but they come to your house, and then let's say four of them throughout the evening that you don't know use your bathroom.
Mm-hmm. They can use
Your bathroom.
Whatever,
they could be transgender. They could sit down, stand up. They could write a note on the mirror with their lipstick. They could do anything. That's your, you know, that's the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand. If it's good enough for your home, why is it not good enough for Arby's? I just don't get it.
What is what's Sean Connery like?
Sean Connery. I'm gonna lie and say he's great.
Who is the most famous of all Scotsmen?
This is a hard one because. In the modern day, I don't really know, but for me personally, Robert Burns.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he wrote Auld Lang Syne, which everybody sings across the world every new year. He wrote My Love Is Like a Red, Red Rose. And the second most popular country for Robert Burns and his work, and that celebrate Burns Night on January the 25th when you eat haggis and drink whiskey, is Russia.
Really? I didn't know that.
Russia, yeah. And I do not have any oil deals with them in saying this. I have no business ties to Russia, but the Russians and the Scottish celebrate Burns Night.
Good God, you have a deep voice. Do
I?
Tell you that?
Well, it's probably because
And you're how tall? You're like 5 foot tall, but you have a voice that's 5 foot
tall.
Because
I'm a hobbit.
Great.
If you could only see my feet.
No, you're what, 5'6", maybe?
I'm 5'7½.
And
a half is really important. Actually, do you know what? It's probably because of every night I'm screaming these punk songs, and then I wake up in the morning and I sound like this. But I probably don't sound like this by the end of the day.
Did you see that he played Boy George?
I did.
Oh, yeah, Taboo. Did you originate
Taboo.
That?
Wow. And he got a Tony Award nomination for
it. Yeah, there you go.
That's pretty impressive.
Okay.
Yeah, it was nice. It was my first job in the U.S., but I didn't win because Hugh Jackman did.
Did you meet Boy George when studying for the role?
He was in the show.
Oh, he was?
Yeah, he played a different character. He played a guy called Lee Bowery.
Really?
Who was a performance artist.
Seems like he would have been cast as himself.
Yeah, no, he was 40-something at the time, and I had to play him at 19, so.
Oh, I see.
No matter how hard he tries, he doesn't look 19 anymore. None of us do. You don't either.
Well, no, neither do I, yeah. What was the story about him chaining someone up? What was that whole deal?
Yes, yes. I'm not sure how true this story is, although they did go to court over it.
Yeah.
He chained up someone because they had come over the week before and stolen his laptop, so he said. So he chained him up and refused to let him go until he admitted where the laptop was.
Huh.
I've done that. I mean, I think it's perfectly normal.
Yeah. We've all done
it. Haven't we all done it? Who has chained up a stranger to get your laptop back?
All right, it's Ewan Morton. He is the star, the title character of Hedvig and the Angry Inch, and it's at the Wind Spear. It'll be there tonight and through the 12th.
That's right.
Okay? Come see him.
Yes.
All right. Thank you, Ewan.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good stuff. That's The Corner. It's 9:33 on The Ticket.